Mr. Gormley, Reel 29. You were with the 2nd Australian Division in Syria, Mr. Gormley. Yeah. What were they like?
Great fellas. Bloody thieves and vagabonds, if you understand what I mean. But they're good fellas, really good fellas to work with. And so good, you know. I'd already met them previous when I first came over, you know, because I actually went there to teach them how to drive through sand.
That's right, yes you did.
I've already mentioned that earlier on, like, you know. And the New Zealand as well. But they needed it because they hadn't been on sand. But, people say the thieves and vagabonds are there. Well, they're not. They're what we call a perpetual scrounger. The good scroungers. They can get anything, anywhere, anytime. We had people like that in our room, actually. I could name quite a few of them.
You got into action once or twice. Do you remember any of those actions and what was happening?
Well, this first action, well, this was, no, that was about the third action. We were in bombs, and then we moved out to Palmyra from Palmyra and come back up, which we found unoccupied. We had 2 or 3 weeks there, and then we came back up, and then we went down towards Damascus. So we find that the place had been taken, but we captured Damascus. But having said that, we were sent up to the foothills of this place, and then we had to move out because our guns wouldn't reach the enemy from where we were. They could reach the enemy, but they couldn't go any further. In other words, there was no way we could knock them back unless we went out in, and we had to go out into this valley. And I've described it before. And we went out into the valley, and we got about 10 rounds back of gunfire or something like that. And we knocked a couple of guns out and damaged a couple of more. And then from then on, it was all, we were only actually on the French artillery ranges.
So yes, I think we got that far.
So we knew exactly, they knew exactly where we were and everything. So all that day, and this is where I'm continuing on from there. Now all that day, we lay there. And we only had a little, very small trench, but only about a foot deep because it was solid rock, and the spoil that came up from it. We lay there all that day, and during the whole of that day, it was only twice that our OP was only about 300 yards from the enemy. And the Australians had done it a long bit of hill in the first instance, which left them in a very exposed position. There was only twice, and they knew straight away that somebody must have had the eye on, because we took posts and we fired off half a dozen rounds of penny towards, and they said, take cover and I'll dive back in the trench, you know. It gave a little lull in the fighting, which was very few. And it was only twice in that day that way, and we still managed to destroy more of their guns, actually.
And you were under shell fire from them? They were shelling you?
Yes. You're just under shell fire all the time. We're not fighting over the wounded. Tell me, we never lost a man killed. And that rain was coming. It was like pretty scary ones coming down, you know.
And this was basically counter battery work. You're trying to look out their batteries.
They were on the top of the hills up there, and the only man that could see them was our OP, because, as I say, the horses had gone up the wrong hill in the first place. And all that day, we stood there under constant gunfire right throughout the day until the night time. Now, when night time fell in, the Palestine police force, a lot of the Palestine police force had been seconded to the Australian teams as supply corps. They because they were all ex-soldiers. You had to be an ex-soldier before you were allowed in the Palestine police force. They were all ex-soldiers, and they used them all as line of communication personnel. And of course they all came flooding over to see if they could do anything for us, because they just sat and watched us getting hammered to hell. And anyway, as dark came, we brought the guns up, the wagons up. The wagons came up, and the limbers were burning and all sorts, you know. I mean, Jordan McGuinness, I mean, he did a thing there that he should have had a medic for, didn't he? Yeah. It was one was burning brightly, right alongside the gun. And he jumped up and he dropped the limber, and he was pulling bloody shells out. Not shells, garbage cases. So he's pulling them out and throwing them away, so the cup shot wouldn't explode, because a lot of them would have gone, couldn't have done any good, because right beside him. So. And he stood there throwing all these shells. And we all thought he should have had another foot anyway.
How do you withstand constant shelling of that nature? It must be pretty stressful. In the middle of it all, you just...
I did. In that particular instance, I'd already done it, but it was going right across the mile, more than half a mile each way. And I came back, like, and I went and saw Corbett, and he sat there and turned up like crazy. And I just jumped out and made me shout. And I fell asleep. And in the end, this lad that was in the next state along, he must have been shouting all right, you know, and he made his mind up that I must have been killed. And he actually crawled from his own shallow over to mine, and he walked and said, "What the bloody hell are you doing, shallow? You're bloody dead."
Some men, you do, because some men must have cracked under this.
Oh, yes.
This tremendous shelling.
I had a lad who was a good lad, and he just couldn't stand shell. So I never used to hit him. If you hit him with a bloody hammer, not a man, tell him to sit down.
Yes, we'll come to that. But that we were just talking in general terms there about the response to heavy shelling.
Well, of course, you know, most of it has already been on the front. We've seen heavy things on the front, you know. But constant shelling, you either adapt to it or you don't. And a lot of them couldn't. Most of them, well, not a lot of them. One or two on every gun. There'd be some that couldn't. And yet they overcame it, like, eventually, you know. But we had a chap, he was a quartermaster, and he was terrified of bloody bottom. Shelling, and that, no problem. Some of them bombers come over, absolutely bloody terrified of bombers. I don't know why.
Anyway, you were in this action we're talking about, yes.
We were in this place here, and well, eventually we got, as I say, the wagons came up, and we, of course, everything, all the guns, they all had pneumatic tyres, and of course, they were all torn to bloody shreds and everything, like, so, but that didn't stop us. We just limbered everything up just as we would normally, and we just dragged everything out into this little enclave in the hills. Which was way back from where we'd actually come from, a little bit further on. And we're right alongside this main road that came down from Baalbek, back down through to Damascus. And we're alongside the road there. And the fitness worked like bloody slaves all that night, cannibalising all the guns. And eventually, they managed to get three guns in operation with the hopes that we'd get a fourth one, which we did. And all that Corbett, he said, "Look at him, see, what's it put on me?" He obviously says, "I haven't been for any bloody thing that was born." And that night, as we pulled up and we got up under this enclave and got the fitness work to get the guns into operation again, he shouted me all, "Bobby, Bobby, here we go again, whatever." "I want you to check the boys' appetite," I will. "And who do you want me?" I said, "Minnie in," because they take me. So that was a pretty good thing. I said, "I'll take Minnie in with us." "Right, I want you to check the boys' anti-tank rifles up there. The enemy's got tanks, and we're expecting to make a tank attack down there before we can get through all gals pulling together, you know. Take the boys' anti-tank rifles and go up there and guard that road, you know, because it's just the road coming through." And we were like all back in the hills. So I said to Vinnie, I said, right, we'll get up there. I said, then when we're ready, we'll just have a kit week. And as long as one of us is keeping away, I said, because you were sitting there, you had to kill. We were fully expecting all these bloody tanks charging down the road. So we sat there all night with these bloody tank rifles. And I mean, they couldn't stop a tank, right? If you hit them right, they're right there, small, right? And anyway, it got towards dawn, like, I seen the cook like making fires up for them, get the char and that on the corner. I said, look after them bloody rifles, Minnie. I said, I'm away down to get some char. But we went down the route and got the char and come back up. And by that time, as I say, it really worked hard. And they got three good guns into action. And as I said, probably a fourth one ready to come into action. So we went straight back into where we come out from originally, which was the position that we'd gone before we moved out into the valley. Which meant that we were still with the enemy, but we couldn't give any advance, you know. So we went back into those positions there, and we were under constant shell fire, because they knew where we were, because every time we fired, we were very commonly situated where we are. We had good wages at it. I don't know how to find places like that, because we were in this, which is a little body, no deeper than about the height of that. And we were, you know, about the height of that. And we were
8 foot, 8 or 9 foot?
And we were dug in behind there. And the foot shells all around us, but they never hit us. That was shelled up all over us, and yet they never could find out how to get into that little one. and for all that, it was our own artillery ranges.
So you were banging away at each other, really, at this point in time?
Bang, bang, over the top, they were bang, bang away.
What's the maximum rate of fire that you can get going with a 25-pounder?
Well, you can't get up to fire.
That's five
in a minute.
But usually three.
Normally three. If you're going rapid fire, you'll get five a minute.
So you soon go through your shells.
You've got shells all over the place, you know. You don't know where you're in the limber and that, you've got the stuff in the guns only.
I was going to ask you how close the shells were to you.
Anywhere you could put shells and cartridges, you're traveling, you're like a walking fireball, you know. Because you had to have as much firepower as you could possibly have, you know. You've got a limber full of ammo, but that didn't last, you know. And that's where your ammo men come in. They've got to come up, irrespective of what's happening around them.
And they're coming up all the time during the action?
They're coming up all the time, mm-hmm.
Who organises that? Is that?
Your own quartermaster organises all that, yeah. He organised everything like that. Group and everything, it was all organised by the quartermaster.
It's quite a responsible job.
Oh, yes. And
And you were a gun aimer at this time, I believe.
I was sight. I was had me on the sight. They wouldn't let anybody else on the sight. They would have had it if it needed to.
And within the team, you'd have a man or men bringing shells to the gun.
I was normally second in command of the gun, I think, at the time, but the point was to put that tucker on the side.
There was French Vichy you were fighting against. Yeah, how were they performing?
They fought like bloody devils. They really did. And why they should have fought against us, I mean, they hate the bloody English, you know. And I'm saying that without fear and favour. I mean, I've never known a Frenchman yet that I was bloody tough. Not as regards where Englishmen were concerned. They would tell you to the bloody devil. They would.
Did you have any free French forces with you in Syria?
No.
You didn't. You saw French. Yeah, you didn't have French fighting French.
No. We didn't have. They had French in the desert.
Yeah.
Oh yes, there were free French forces in the desert.
Not in Syria, with you.
They had their own commanders in the desert. And, well, they were down with Baal HaTamar later on, you know. And, but as I say, we had...
You were in the shelling counter-battery work.
We got this counter-battery work, and there was an incident happened there. And it just proves, well, it proved to me, that these Kitty Hawk fighters going over, stuffing them. And this Kitty Hawk fighter had made a forced landing right behind where our gun pit was. The pilot got out and came and he stopped in our gun pit. Couldn't get him out yet. He just got down in the command post where he was, like, because that was the dangerous place to get shelter, like, you know. And he stayed there all day until we could get him out of there. And towards evening, when the shelling had died down a bit, I went over and had a look at it. And I called back and I said, I can't see any more of it. He says, "You don't throw with him?" And this was this pilot who was talking to me. I said, "No, I haven't got any clue." I said, "Didn't look as over there." He says, "There's one bullet hole there, went through the bloody cooling system. One bullet hole. Somebody must have just took a random shot, because there's no way you could fire it with one bullet. It's broke, you know, they'll do without the greatest of look, like, you know." And one shot had gone through the bloody cooling system and brought the whole thing clean down.
Where were your guns in relation to the actual fighting troops in the front line? How far, what distance are we talking about?
Well, when they got up the right hill, I mean, our OP was up there all the time. We never came down.
And he'd be on his own, presumably, for a time.
He was on his own with his OP up. And he never ever came down for that hill.
And this wireless communication, yeah, back to the guns.
Wireless communication, back there, and of course, you had to be very quiet about it all, because you only 300 yards from the French. And eventually, the French, the Aussies went up on the right hill, but then they were engaged by the enemy at as a normal distance, you know. And I thought we're still 100 yards in front of them, you know. And so we had a good sight of everything that was going on. They never ever found him like that, Major Wagstaff. They never ever found him. They knew he was there because he was too active, you know. But once we got back in our own positions, where we were firing from, we were reasonably safe, so he was able to direct the fire more or less with impunity.
Was there ever a situation where an OP couldn't get into a good position, they had to fire off the map? Did you ever fire off maps?
Oh, yes, you fire off the map.
But that would be later, was it?
Well, you've got all your grids and everything laid out, you know. And once you get a ranging shot, you use what you call a ranging shot. You get one in and two in. And once you get one in and you bracket it, you see, even though you haven't got anything to aim at, really, but once you've bracketed that, you can just bring it down bit by bit until you actually hit them. You know, what you call ranging shots. You put two ranging shots in, one there and one here.
One beyond and one in front, kind of thing.
One in front of them. And then you just either creep up or creep down, you know. And that was the...
Had your training also involved creeping barrage?
Oh, yes, you have a creeping barrage. Which
and you've done this, in your training?
Everything's worked to an nth degree. They do not move. They do not move. The infantry do not move. They know exactly. And it's timed. Everything's timed to the minute. To the minute. It's timed right to the second. Happened at the minute. And that creeping barrage will go forward. And then that barrage will stop. It lifts. And then as that lifts, they move forward. But they only go so far. They know exactly. They've already been warned. They don't go past there because otherwise they get they'll be under their own shelter. And you keep up there.
And you keep within, obviously, infantry keep within a certain distance of those shells for them.
Yes.
So it's like a curtain of shells, is it?
It's just like a curtain. You put a whole barrage goes down. I mean, they did the same in
You should come to me later. Yeah. Just while we're on the subject, how long or how many shots does a gun fire before it begins to, in effect, become less accurate? There must be an ultimate time limit on how many shells a gun can set off. You may have to make adjustments of some kind.
The only thing that wears out is the rifling. It's the rifling in the barrel that causes the inaccuracy. And that's high tensile steel.
So it takes a long time.
I wouldn't like to have it to get, to be honest. I've never known what to wear out it, actually.
So that you're in this position, you'd have this counter battery work, and the Australians had taken the right hill, as we say. What happened next?
Well, they got up the right hill, but they were all very stubborn resistance. Very stubborn, you know. And of course, everything was in their favour, you know, even though they'd gone up the right hill. They were still. And so eventually, what they did, they took one, two of ours. And there's a battalion of the infantry, and while we were enfiladed in the front, they took us on a detour. We went right round the bloody miles, right away round, and come right in behind them. This was just on the road to Baalbek, you see, and this was the defences of Baalbek, which is further, about 15 miles further along the road. And we come in behind them. Of course, we've been made up of a full complement of 6 guns then. And Don Troop remained in the trailing positions. We come up with this Aussie battery, Aussie infantry, second eighth, I think it was. And I think that's what it was, second eighth. And we made this detour right the way around. And we're coming right at the back end of them. And of course, that was when they said, wait, this is it. And nobody knew we were there. I don't know, but we'd all got there, all the more or less undercover. It took us about 3 days to detour around.
And you were marching during daylight. You were going round in daylight.
Oh, yes. Yes, until we got near enough where we wanted to be, and because it was all mountain covered, okay, and so when we were there, ready to open up, that was it. The foot had been pushed in then, and everybody went forward, and of course, as soon as we had to come in from the back, that was it to do. They were up, around, might have fought all the way back into Baalbek. They just kept delaying the force all the way along. And we got into Baalbek, not that we had time to stop and look around, and I couldn't even describe it here, except I knew it was a lot of dirty old ruins, you know, because we didn't, you know, we just kept going. And they were still making stern resistance all the way down. And this went on for about 3 weeks, I think, like that, before we actually got Baalbek itself and had them on the road.
Have you an idea of what the date was at this time?
Probably about September, October.
1941.
Yeah, it'd be something like that, September, October. But I know we were up on the, and as we approached Beirut, we could look right down across the valley, and we could see the other company, the other Aussies coming up the other road from Tel Aviv, where, and they'd come up the coast road all the way. And they were fighting all the way up, and we could see them from off the hilltop where we were. We could see them back on the way like at the bottom.
Were you attached to a particular battalion or brigade of Australian infantry? that you were working with?
Well, the one I was working with was the second day.
Second day.
That's the one that comes straight to my mind that I'm thinking. And so it was the second day that we were with, like. And we came down there, and we got up the Bay Road, above Bay Road, there was a big ski resort there. Now we were in snow. Even in the summer, you know, the snow was up there, there was a big ski slope, and everything going down, you know, the ski slope. Not that we had time to stop and see anything about it then. So we were pushing on, and we got down into the outskirts of Bay Road, and we fought all the bloody way through it. We were still fighting to the bloody end, and there was a lot of Senegalese troops mixed in among them. And this general that I had, I don't know what the hell I call him now, but he was definitely anti-British. And he surrendered. And we went in and occupied this barracks. Right on the seafront in Beirut. Right on the seafront, overlooking the sea all the time. I went in there and I had never ever seen a barracks in the most beautiful barracks to look at. It was absolutely bloody disgusting. I'd been in there and every room that I'd been in, they used it as a toilet. And they sat in it. And the whole bloody barrack room was like that, right away through. Big, beautiful barracks. And used it. There were toilets and ablutions and that on every floor, you know. And they just shit whatever they wanted to. And they'd been living among that lot all the time. It took us 3 days to get that just, you know, cleaned out.
Was this French African troops that had been in before, or actual French Europeans?
Well, I think it's been a bit of both. They'd all got in there and they either would come fight, they couldn't to go anywhere from where they lived. They just done everybody business right there. I'd never seen anything like anybody like before. Never, ever. And I don't know where the hell they put them. They must have took them away somewhere, like, because we never saw them before.
They're taking them prisoners?
Yeah.
You didn't actually come across any French prisoners at any time?
Just as well as really didn't, because they'd abused all our prisoners. All the prisoners that had been taken by them, and the Senegalese troops were known to have slit many a man's throat on that campaign.
And was this common knowledge amongst you?
Well, it was common knowledge amongst us. We knew when the blokes had started, they wouldn't feed them and things like that.
Was this the end then of the campaign in Syria when you got to Beirut?
That was the end of the campaign. We stayed there for about 3 weeks. That was all. With enough time to see the flesh pots, etc. Put on all the antibiotics and that. No, we had time to look around and see everything, and then we were under orders to move again. And of course, we came back along the coast road, the way the others had come. Now that was all fresh fruit stuff. We'd never been to that area before. And we just went down all the way down there and made all the way back towards Egypt, you know.
Was this a divisional move, or were you...
No, just our own regiment.
Just your own regiment. Had the Australians stayed there?
The Australians stayed and took over Beirut and that, yeah.
Because after the Japanese came in December, the Australians went back to Australia, didn't they? And had to be replaced.
Yes,
but this is before that.
That was later on. Yeah.